we'll pause on that one there. If you turn your Bibles to Luke chapter 23, we're going to be looking at Luke's version of what happened today. Luke 23. Last week, we looked at the Palm Sunday, and we discussed how Jesus had entered into Jerusalem. We said that he did it for a very specific reason. It was time for him to deliver himself into the hands of those who would kill him. As I said last week, Jesus was in control of all of this. And it's important to note that not only then, but today, God is still in control of all the details in our lives. We have to know that. Sometimes people try to conjure up enough in their hearts to want to believe without truly believing. But today, he's still in control of all the details, whether we see it or not. That's the thing sometimes that people have a hard time understanding. But I don't see him. We'll see that today with Thomas. If I see him, if I see the holes in his hands and in his side, then I'll believe it, right? Yesterday would be the anniversary where he would have his Last Supper with his disciples. It's celebrated in the Christian calendar as Maundy Thursday, if you've never heard that before. The word Maundy, it is derived from the Latin word for command. The Maundy in Maundy Thursday refers to the command that Jesus gave the disciples in that Last Supper, that they should love and to serve one another. That was his command, love one another. He gave them an example of that, by the way. How? By washing their feet. But he also gave them the command to observe the sacrament of communion, which is what we're going to observe today. He says, as often as you do this, do it in memory of me. But now the meal's done. The observance of Passover was complete. The week started with a triumph, as you remember, as we saw last week. As Jesus had come into the city, people had greeted him, laying palm branches at his path. He had turned his wrath upon the money changers and taught in the courtyard and in the temple. Tonight, however, the mood changes, and it will change drastically. And no one could define the atmosphere that was going on around there. It was, no doubt, had to be ominous, had to be expectant, or perhaps maybe something unexpected would take place. They had no idea what was going on. They knew not what was about to happen just hours later when they're having this meal. And as a small group in the upper room, they finished their meal. Their leader, Jesus, did something that placed all of us here in the direct line, which takes us back to that room. So many years later, over 2,000 years later, it's going to put us back in that room. It says that then he took a loaf of bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it, and he gave it to them, saying, "This is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." Think about that for a second. They had no idea. To them, that was like, well, I guess he's just giving us a symbol. They had no idea of the body that was going to be broken. And he did the same with the cup after supper, saying, "This is the cup that is poured out for you, is the new covenant in my blood." Still. Well, that's out of, we're not in Luke, but this is what he said in there. He's having the supper with them, and he's going about this process and telling them this. We take that out of 1 Corinthians chapter 11, with Paul giving the example. But on that first Maundy Thursday, Christ himself presided at the first communion. Isn't that amazing to think about that? He gave the very first communion. Even they didn't even know at the time of what that was. But in the days before that evening, Christ had given himself to the world. He had given himself as the Messiah to the crowds that were waving the palm branches. He had given himself as a judge to the money changers. Remember that? Driving them out of the house. And he had given himself as a teacher to the religious inquirers in the temple courtyard. Remember it said that he went on daily and he was teaching in the temple and what was happening? The people were listening. They were attentive to what he was saying. Now, however, he gave himself to his own, to his followers, to his disciples. He's doing it to them now. Everything is about them. He's focusing on them. They were already marked, if you remember back, by the baptism of John in the Jordan. The Jordan River, by the way, and just as we're earmarked by baptism today through the Trinity, as Kay will see coming up. But here, in the seclusion of this upper room that they're in, and they're hidden from the eyes of the world, he gives himself exclusively to the church and to no one else. He's dealing with them. They're going to have to receive now everything that he has for them. And the following day, which is today, Good Friday, he'd take upon himself the sin and the suffering of the whole creation. And today, in the early hours, Jesus is arrested. And ironically, he undergoes six trials before we get into our verses. But he would undergo six trials, and you've heard me teach this before. They were illegal trials, by the way, by the Jewish law. They were all illegal, all six of them. He would be brought before Pilate. Matter of fact, Jesus is arrested at night, and all through the night he would be tried by several entities. Can you imagine that? We get prepared for one trial, right? They give you a date, you show up, all that stuff, and there's anticipation before that and then after that, but one trial. We can barely get through one trial, but he had six trials in that night. He was betrayed by Judas, and the plan was set into motion, and we're brought to his standing before Pontius Pilate, the Roman judge, and we pick up in Luke 23 and in verse 13, if you will. He's standing before Pilate, and it says, "Then Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, and said to them, 'You have brought this man to me as one who misleads the people. And indeed, having examined him in your presence, I have found no fault in this man concerning those things of which you accuse him.'" Verse 15, neither did Herod, for I sent you back to him, and indeed nothing deserving of death has been done by him. I will therefore chastise him and release him." Verse 74, it was necessary for him to be released, to release one of them at the feast. Verse 18, and then they all cried out at once, saying, "Away with this man and release to us Barabbas, who had been thrown into prison for a certain rebellion made in the city and for murder." Pilate, therefore, wishing to release Jesus again, called out to them, but they shouted, crying, "Crucify him, crucify him." And then he said to them the third time, "Why, what evil has he done? I have found no reason for death in him, and I will therefore chastise him and let him go." But they were insistent, demanding with loud voices that he be crucified. And the voices of these men and the chief priests prevailed. So Pilate gave sentence that if it should be as they requested, and he released to them the one they requested, who for rebellion and murder and had been thrown into prison, but he delivered Jesus to their will. I'm going to stop there for a moment. There's a couple of things that I want us to look at here, and I want to share in our verses. But we're going to have to look at what is known as the Synoptic Gospels to see the whole picture. One day I hope to do a study on that, what the Synoptic Gospels are. That's Matthew, Mark, and Luke. The word synoptic literally means together sight. Okay, that's what those three Gospels are. Wherever they cover many of the same events in Jesus' life, they cover them in a little different fashion. Nonetheless, they cover them. I'll share more on that later. But also, it comes as no surprise because of what we see out of those Synoptic Gospels, why it intrigues me so much of why they did what they did, especially having a law enforcement background. The night of Jesus' arrest, he was brought before Annas, Caiaphas, and an assembly of religious leaders called the Sanhedrin. And we see that in your handout with your scriptures. If somebody would pick up John 18, verses 19 through 24 for me, you don't even have to search for it.
"The high priest then asked Jesus about his disciples and his doctrine. Jesus answered him, 'I spoke openly to the world. I always taught in
synagogues
and in the temple where the Jews always meet. And in secret I have said nothing.'"
All the way through 24.
Oh, yeah. 24. Okay. "'Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. Indeed, they knew and what I said. And when he had said these things, one of the officers who stood by my struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, 'Do you answer the high priest like that?' Jesus answered him, 'If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why do you strike me?' Then Annas said, 'Him bound to
Caiaphas,
the high priest.'"
Amen. Amen. Think about that for a second. The guy takes his hand and he hits Jesus in the face. Can you ask yourself, or can you imagine yourself, Would you have the calmness to say, hey, why did you hit me?
No.
No.
No, no.
No, no.
No, none of us in here would do that, right? Not even the women. They'd find a bat. You want to hit me? Okay, let's see why. But then he tells them, do you answer? Well, the guy says, do you answer the high priest like that? That stood out to me. I'm thinking, they have no idea who he is. The high priest has the preeminence, has the authority and all that. They don't even realize that they're talking to God. That's what troubles me about that. But Jesus said, if I have spoken evil, then bear witness of the evil. Tell me what evil I did. But if well, meaning if I have spoken well, then why'd you strike me? That's the only conversation he's having with them. And in Matthew 26, verse 57, somebody want to grab that?
And those who had laid hold of Jesus led him away to, but how did you say that?
Caiaphas.
The high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled.
Amen. After this, he was taken before Pilate, the Roman governor, and we see in John 18:23. But in John 18:23 is where John lists that. And then he sent off to Herod. And in Luke 23:7, you see it down there. And as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at the time. These, what they did is they returned him back to Pilate, who finally sentenced him to death. He would finally say, okay, do what you're going to do. Basically is what he said. And these were six parts of Jesus's trial. Three stages in a religious court and three stages in a Roman court. Jesus was tried before Annas, the former high priest, Caiaphas, the current high priest, and the Sanhedrin. He was charged in these ecclesiastical trials, is what they were, with blasphemy, claiming to be the Son of God, claiming to be the Messiah. The trials before the Jewish authorities, the religious trials, showed that the degree to which Jewish leaders hated him because they carelessly disregarded many of their own laws. When they were trying him, they went against their own laws. And there were several illegalities that were involved in these trials. Number one, no trial was to be held during feast time, and it was already the Passover. Number two, each member of the court was to vote individually to convict or acquit. But Jesus was convicted by acclamation. All in favor, say aye. Number three, if the death penalty was given, a night must pass before the sentence was carried out. They would have had to wait another night. However, only a few hours passed before Jesus was placed on the cross. Totally against the law. Why were they in such a hurry? Because of the Passover. Number four, the Jews had no authority to execute anybody. They had to go to the Romans. Number five, no trial was to be held at night, but this trial was held before dawn. They would have had to wait until the sun came up to try him. Number six, the accused was to be given counsel or representation, but Jesus had nobody. He was by himself. I got a question for you. Does God need a mediator? Does he need a counselor? No. The Bible tells us he is the mighty counselor, right? Matter of fact, it tells us there's no mediator between God, between Christ and God. He is our mediator. He's the one who stands before us when Satan comes to try to accuse us and tries to try us. But number seven, the accused was not to be asked self-incriminating questions, but Jesus was asked if he was the... They could incriminate him. Now, how many of you know that Jesus knew all of these laws? He knew all these rules. He knew them all. The trials before the Roman authorities started with Pilate. And we saw that in John 18:23, and after Jesus was beaten, the charges brought against him was very different from the charges of the religious trials. He's going back and forth. You're being told that you're an insurrectionist. You're rioting people up to overthrow the government. Sound familiar? But also, you're blasphemous. You're saying you're the Son of God. He was charged with inciting people to riot, forbidding the people to pay their taxes, and claiming to be the king. See? But what I find interesting in Luke 23:7, it says on your sheet, and as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who also was in Jerusalem at the time. Pilate found no reason to kill Jesus, so he sends him to Herod. And they're going this back and forth seesaw. No, you take him. No, it's a hot potato. You take him. But Herod had Jesus ridiculed, wanting to avoid the political liability that was going on, and he sent him back to Pilate. And in verses 11 and 12 of our study, we see that. I'm going to read that again. And then Herod with his men of war treated him with contempt and mocked him, arrayed him in the glorious robe and sent him back to Pilate. That very day, Pilate and Herod became friends with each other, for previously they had been at enmity with each other. Jesus has a way of bringing enemies together. In a very, very small way, I'll just throw this out there. I remember when I was in California, I had two guys that did not get along with each other. They just did not like each other. And they were, one was one of my elders, and one was a deacon. But when time came for them to turn on both of me, guess who became friends? They did. They always hung out together. And they thought that it was going to offend me, but I said, wow, I kind of feel like Jesus felt in bringing two enemies together. They didn't like that. But this was the last trial as Pilate tried to appease the animosity of the Jews by having Jesus scourged. Can you imagine that he has him scourged? Well, I'll do this then. It's the least I can do. And then parade him out there. And it's important to know that the Roman scourge, as we have read so much, was a terrible whipping. And it was designed to remove the flesh from the back of the person that was being whipped. But for Jesus, it went further than that. It was across his chest, across his legs, across his back. Everywhere that that whip could hit, they hit him. In a final effort to have Jesus released, Pilate offered the prisoner Barabbas to be crucified, and Jesus released. Can you imagine that? Take your worst murderer. Do you want me to release Jesus, or you want this murderer? Give us the murderer. We don't want Jesus. Think about that for a moment. What if it was your relative that he murdered? But the crowd called for Barabbas to be released and the Jesus to be crucified. And in verse 18 of Luke 23, it says, and they all cried out at once, saying, away with this man, and release to us Barabbas, who had been thrown into prison for a certain rebellion made in the city and for murder. He was known in that city. They knew what he did, and they still wanted him released. The religious leaders wanted a man who was evil, a man who was vile, a man who was a thief and a murderer. And this touches at the heartstrings of what Jesus had called these folks in the Gospel of Matthew. If you recall, being sarcastic with him, they asked for a sign. And in Matthew 16:4, Jesus replies, a wicked and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and no sign shall be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. And it says he left them and he departed. You guys want a sign? Only a wicked and vile generation, adulterous generation. That's what he was telling them. You guys are all adulterers and you're vile. You know, they didn't take too kindly to that, by the way. Now here they are thinking that they were getting even with him. As religious and as right as they thought themselves to be, they had made a grave mistake. But Jesus, think about this for a moment. He allowed them to do it. He allowed them to make that mistake. Pilate granted their demand and surrendered Jesus to their will. And we see that in verse 25 of chapter 23. What does it say? And he released to them the one they requested for the rebellion and murder had been thrown into prison. But he delivered Jesus to their will. See, the trials of Jesus represent the ultimate mockery of justice. Jesus, the most innocent man in the history of the world, was found guilty of crimes and sentenced to death by crucifixion, of crimes that he never committed. Philip Keller, in his book, Rabboni, says Jesus was stretched out on the ground on the crossbeam, the hammer, iron on iron, sent nails into his sinews and flesh. Blood squirts from the wounds each time the spikes are pounded deeper into the wood. And then his feet are laid flat on the wood with his legs drawn up. Two more terrible spikes do their dreadful work, just like the thousands of other lambskins stretched out in the mid-morning sun that day. So also God's Passover lamb lay stretched out on the skull hill, suspended between heaven and earth as a supreme substitute. Kind of puts it into a picture that you just can't get out of your head. And now Jesus hangs on the cross, as we see in verse 44 of this chapter. And it was about the sixth hour, and there was darkness over all the earth until the ninth hour. Think about that for a moment. From 12 until 3 in the afternoon, it was dark. I've shared this with you before, but a little side note here. Back in August 21st of 2017, you remember, we were blessed to experience the total eclipse of the sun here in Oregon, weren't we? All of us. I mean, people came from thousands of miles just to see it. I'm so thankful we just went out to our driveway. But I remember for approximately 1 minute at 10:30 that morning, it got so dark that you could see the stars and the moon. That's how dark it was. I remember looking out to the chair on the side, and I couldn't see Char for 1 minute. But here it tells us that that lasted for 3 hours, if you can imagine that. Think about something a little bit more, because we experienced not only the darkness, but the temperature dropped drastically. It started getting a little bit morning chill. Like at 10:30 in August, it's pretty warm here. But the chill came down. I'm like, oh my gosh, the whole world is affected like this. And then I have to ask, do you think that that got anybody's attention? I think it did. He's hanging on the cross, and then all of a sudden it gets dark. I think that's a little bit too late to go, uh-oh, I think we made a mistake. One of the things that why I point that out is because in the Old Testament, darkness relates to the judgment of God. And indeed, the judgment of sin was being laid on his son, his only son. My son called me last night and told me he's sick, got sick again. And there's just something about, you guys all know it, when your child calls you to tell you they're sick, you're like, oh man, I wish I could take that from you. I'm going to be praying for you that you get better. Do what you need to get better. Mark says the crucifixion began at 9 a.m. in the morning. For 6 torturous hours, Jesus hangs on this cross. 6 hours. We're told that to breathe, he'd had to stretch himself upward, pushing himself against the spikes that are in his feet just so he could breathe. His lungs were collapsed. I can imagine every movement of the searing pain that shoots through his body. His legs must cramp. Danny, you know about that. Working out, cramping into knots. I get a cramp in the middle of the night. What do? I got to fly out of bed and push down on my foot. I'm just like, oh, this hurts. Can you imagine? He had to go through that just to breathe, knowing every time that he pushed himself up, he was going to get those cramps.
Well, lest we forget that just the crucifixion itself would be painful, let alone the fact that he'd already been scourged.
Exactly.
Beyond recognition.
Exactly.
He's enduring that.
Because of the weight of his body on that cross, no doubt, when his hands were stretched out, it had to have dislocated his shoulders. But think about that for a moment. It's hot, and his skin runs with sweat, and all the salt from the sweat running down all of the flagellation that they did to him, burning. And we complain when we don't feel well or things are not going as we would like them to. But there's so much more that a person could relate to in these verses. But for time's sake, I'd like to just kind of highlight these particular points. In all 4 Gospels, 2 things above all stand out in the crucifixion story. First, there's an amazing restraint with which the most brutal and dastardly crime of all history is described. For example, none of the Gospels even tell us that the nails were driven through his hands and feet, if you've never noticed that before. So where do we get that from? We know it only through the mention later of the wounds, as mentioned in John 20:25. The other disciples therefore said to him, Thomas, "We have seen the Lord." And so he said to them, "Unless I see his hands, the print of the nails, and put my finger into the print of the nails and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." I got to know it's him. And of course, relating to what Doubting Thomas said, that it would take that for him to believe. Isn't that cool when Jesus later on, I mean, he goes to where they are and walks through the door. I mean, closed door, by the way. It's not even open. That would be enough for me to say, "I believe, I believe, I believe. I don't need to see no more," right? But he walks in and he goes, "Thomas, you unbelieving rascal." He didn't tell him that. He goes, "Come and put your hands in there and see if it isn't me." He didn't even have to do it. He just looks at him and goes, "My Lord and my God." Also, there's no detailed description of the physical sufferings. The full horror of the scene stands out more clearly because there's no attempt to stir up the emotions for everybody. The second, throughout the dreadful hours of Jesus' death, there is an unmistakable impression that in reality, He's controlling the course of the events. Well, the day turns dark, the curtain tears, and the people mourn. Jesus stays faithful to the end, committing his spirit to God. His innocence is affirmed again, and the centurion declares him a righteous and innocent man. Think about that for a moment. Truly, he was a righteous man. They'd already done the damage, but truly, he really was who he said he was. To the very end, what comes out of Jesus, the words from his lips are words of mercy and hope and trust for each and every one of us. And Jesus dies the faithful and righteous servant of the Lord, as he's prophesied hundreds of years before by the prophet Isaiah, Isaiah 53:11. If you're taking notes, it says, "He shall see the labor of his soul and be satisfied. And by his knowledge, my righteous servant shall justify many, for he shall bear their iniquities." The great question that we have, even more so, is why do we call this Good Friday? But it comes to us when we meditate on Jesus' death. Why? Why all this beating? Why all the blood? Why did he have to go? Why all the mocking? Was it all necessary? And the answer is yes. And the reason the answer is yes is because sin is that ugly. I shared with you earlier the video that just rocked me. I looked at it and thought, even more than the blood and everything that I saw was like, we did that. Because of our sin, he had to do that for us. And he didn't hold back. Spurgeon quoted on this. He said, "The crucifixion of Christ was the crowning sin in our race. In his death, we shall find all the sins of mankind uniting in foul conspiracy, envy and pride and hate are there, with covetousness and blasphemy, eager to rush on to cruelty, revenge, and murder. As all the rivers run into the sea, and as all the clouds empty themselves upon the earth, so did all the crimes of man gather to the slain of the Son of God." Jesus died on that Passover day because he had to. It was the only way that we could be reconciled to God the Father. Imagine what it must have been like on this day for his mother, who stood there watching him. His disciples, who were wanting so much more from him as his followers. And they just looked and saw all this that was going on. They must have felt that all hope was lost. And I know for you and I, we know the end, don't we? Today's Friday. The Sunday's coming. They didn't know that. They didn't have that at a time. But even though he told them, "In 3 days I will rise again," they were so focused on the pain and the hurt of watching their beloved leader suffer the pain that he did. And I'm glad that we don't have to wait till Sunday to receive him. Aren't you? Yeah. We don't have to wait. He was tried and found guilty of crimes that he didn't commit. Think about that. I'm sure we got people in prison today who were innocent of their crimes. And, you know, the biggest thing they're now thanking God for is DNA testing. Because it's helping them. He was beaten, he was scoffed, and treated like dirt for you and I. He was hung on a cross to pay a debt of sin that you and I could never afford to pay. And so I really need to ask the question. Every one of us need to think this way. Think about this, I should say. If the requirement today was to do what he did in all that we have discussed, how many of us would seek salvation? Not a single one of us. If it was laid out to us, here's the way to salvation. You're going to get scourged. You're going to get beaten. You're going to get mocked and get spit on. We're going to put a bag over your head, and we're going to punch you, and you're not even going to know who it was. And we're going to ask you, tell us which one it was. Then we're going to drag you out in front of everybody. We're going to nail you to a cross, and you're going to die a horrible death. Don't you want to be saved? None of us would do that. I wouldn't. That's why I'm so thankful that Jesus did it for us. He did it for you and he did it for me so that we wouldn't have to do that. And that's why he is always Savior and Lord, Adonai, and the Son of God, and the Messiah. I don't care what religion people are. Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus is God. And so, because he is, I want us to, we're going to have communion. I'll have Linda get communion ready. And I want us to view the video that I normally put on for at a time like this, just to kind of give us just a reminder. It's not gory. You've seen it before. You're still here.